Ask any parent and they'll tell you raising children is rewarding and challenging.
If you're a new parent, maybe you turn to self-help books for answers to common questions but found that one size doesn't really fit all.
Our next guest decided to shake things up and take a different approach to navigating the twists and turns of modern parenting. Dalton Conley is a professor of sociology at New York University and author of the new book, Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children, But We're Too Exhausted to Ask. Dalton, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
I want to start with your terminology here. Parentology, how do you define that?
Well, it's a word I made up, of course, but what it really means is that what I think is a uniquely American style of parenting, which is very improvisational. We don't follow some ancient Chinese or French tradition that's been passed down for thousands of years. We're an immigrant society. We invent things as we go along. And I'm advocating or trying to formalize that approach in this book by suggesting that, yes, we should improvise and adapt to our kids or the unique aspects of our kids, but we should do it with the scientific method in mind and hypothesis testing and trial and revision and trial and error and revision. And then I called it parentology to make it scientific.
Well, you tried lots of stuff that probably comes across as unorthodox to a lot of parents out there, but you were basing what you did on science, and I wonder what is it you wanted to get out of your, I won't say experiments with your children, but as you went along, out of your parentology, what was the result you wanted for your kids?
Well, I come from a position as a scientist where I'm kind of overwhelmed myself by all the science out there. You know, anything you could imagine about your kids' lives has been studied one way or another. For example, having kids in the fall, having them born in the fall, it affects their life expectancy, you know, past age 50, compared to having them positively, compared to having them born in the spring, which is a negative effect. So, you know, for me, I discovered that research study too late. I had my kids at the wrong time of year, but it is quite overwhelming, and I try to argue in the book that any kind of self-help guide that just says, like, here's the 7 points to successful children is selling you snake oil, and really what you need is sort of, I try to show through example the way of just sort of making sense of the science and how you might apply it to your own kids. So, for example, I saw they diagnosed my son with ADHD, and the school wanted him to go on to medication, Adderall. And I resisted that because I knew that the science was mixed on whether it actually on long term it works or not. And also just, you know, of course, it makes any parent nervous to give a pharmaceutical to their kid. But I did know another research literature that showed that placebo effects were huge. In fact, they were almost as big as the actual treatment, particularly with mental health or psychological or behavioral treatments. So his mother and I went along with it, and we decided to give him a placebo, an herbal pill, and lie to him, to the school, to his sister, to basically the whole social world, thought he was being medicated. And we wanted to see if that worked in terms of solving the attentional issues in school.
Well, what happened?
That particular, I probably shouldn't start with that example because that particular experiment did not work. It worked for about 2 weeks until people said, well, maybe you need to switch the medication. It's not working. And eventually we did give in and get him on ADHD prescription medication. Another example was their names. They have very unusual names, both of my kids. And there's a whole research literature on having a more male name or a more female name, a more unique name, a racially tinged name, what the effects of that are. And I read it as unusual names lead to children learning to control their impulses. If they get teased or something like that, they learn to bite their tongue. And this leads to success. The people with unusual names are disproportionately represented in Who's Who, for example.
Right, and I guess the science says that people who have better impulse control are a lot more successful, even with people than higher IQs.
Right. That's a very, very in vogue area of research on child development now, what's called non-cognitive skills, that perseverance, impulse control, those kind of skill sets that are not really, they're correlated with your IQ, but they're distinct from it. And some people argue are more important than your actual cognitive ability.
Now, are the names that you give your kids in the book their real names?
They are.
They are. Can you tell us what they are, just to give a sense of how far you went with this?
So my daughter's name is E, just the letter E, no period. We actually thought it was going to stand for something, but we wanted to give her some interactivity there and let her choose what it stood for when she got old enough to make such a decision. But so far, and she's at the peak rebellion time of age 16, she has stuck with E and she loves it. And my son, well, once you name your first kid E, you really can't name your second kid, John, or you could, I guess, but we went for another unusual name, and in his name, we kind of confounded ethnic stereotypes. So he's a, blue-eyed white kid, and his name is Yoxing, but he's got a long name, Yoxing Haino Augustus Eisner Alexander Weiser Knuckles. And because his sister got to have some control over her name, two of those names in there were actually ones that he picked himself and illegally inserted when he was about 3 or 4. So, yes, they have very unusual names. Everybody in the school knows who they are. They're not confused. And, that has its own effects on their social and emotional development, I think. Now you could.
Do you think that it's working out the way you planned it, that they are learning impulse control, or is the verdict still out? They're just too young.
Yeah, they have different abilities of impulse control between them, I'd say. But I would say that, even though people who've heard that name, those names have called me a child abuser and other bad words, they both love them. They would not trade them for the world. E, as I mentioned, she could have easily adopted Ellen, which is my mother's name, or Elizabeth or something like that, and she has resisted that. And both of them love their names. So it's part of who they are. And for better or worse. So
yeah.
I do think it has had a slightly positive effect on them, but again, there's no control group.
One of the things I wonder about is the limitations of science. You're going to the scientific literature, you're looking at what's really out there. I assume you're looking for quality studies that really seem to say something that's been well-researched. But science changes. If you look at, the only example I can think of off the top of my head is nuts. Maybe 10 years ago, nuts were going to kill you and you shouldn't eat them. And now nuts are being touted as a health food. Is the same true of the science on parenting, that if you run with one of these things, it might be just overturned in a year?
That is true. The science completely, changes over time. I'll give you a more risque example, circumcision. So at the time that my son was born, the fashion among highly educated individuals, in fact, the recommendation of the American Pediatric Association was not to circumcise, that the pain and so forth involved to a young infant, they in fact showed that it changed their pain reactivity 6 months or a year or even 2 years later. So it was a traumatic event and had lasting psychological consequences. Okay, so that kind of, on that science just made the decision. But then about 5 or 6 years later, there were huge trials going on in Africa look at the effect of circumcision on transmission of sexually transmitted diseases, specifically AIDS. And they found that circumcision was an incredibly successful way of cutting down males acquiring HIV and other viruses. And it was so stark and so dramatic, the science, that they actually called off the treatment and control group and offered the service to anybody because they thought it would be unethical to keep going. So they're now I don't know where the American Pediatric Association stands, but basically now that science has been overturned, and we go back to the Old Testament, and Abraham was right, I guess. And who knows, in 5 years again, they may say don't circumcise. So clearly, it's a shifting landscape, and enough to make anybody, any parent or researcher for that matter, a little crazy.
Well, we're talking right now with Dalton Conley, author of the book Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children. But we're too exhausted to ask. We're talking about the way he's used science and applied it in how he's raised his children and the different outcomes that he's had.
And we want to hear from you. What was your approach to raising children? Did you try to apply the latest science, as our guest has done, to your child-rearing style, or you just kind of wing it? Are there elements of parenting you have questions about? Maybe you want to ask our guest. Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org.
And Dalton, we've been talking about some of the sociological aspects and impulse control, some things like that. What about some of the basics, reading and writing and math, things that we assume our kids are going to need to know to have mastery over their education and to advance? Let's take reading. Are there recommendations about how we should introduce kids to reading?
Well, there is an example of where I kind of went against, you know, what teachers and the educational establishment generally recommends, and instead I followed what I thought was the cutting edge research. So what I did for my own kids, for example, and I'm not advocating, I should say at the outset, this is not an instruction book. This is like a show by example. So you see my examples, you could think I would want to do exactly the opposite of that, or you could, why don't I try that? That's an interesting thing. But really, it's the methodology I want to get across. So in the case of reading, what I knew from the research literature was that it's not really important when kids start to learn to decode the words on the page themselves. So as long as they can do it by the time they're in first grade or maybe even later, as long as they don't fall too far behind, what is really important is that they understand complex, a lot of words, they have a big vocabulary, and that they understand complex sentence structure and syntax. So basically, I left it to the school to teach my kids how to actually read, and I instead just read to them, and we talked about the books, and we, defined words and had interactive reading sessions constantly, but never actually showed them how to, decode the word to sound out the word, cat or hat or what have you, see spot run. In first grade, they were among the lowest testing kids in reading, and it started to panic a little bit about the approach. But by fifth grade, they were at the top of the class, and their verbal ability, their non-reading verbal ability in that whole interim period was always sort of high and off the charts. So in that case, it paid off. But again, if a kid, what the science says is that for each kid, it may be different. So a kid with dyslexia may require actually explicit training on how to visually decode words, but most kids are going to figure it out. And much more important to focus on their understanding and comprehension.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got John on the line from Stevens Point. Hi, John.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always been interested in psychology in raising kids. And me and my wife, we have three boys. We have a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 2-year-old. And I'm a big fan of Daniel Goleman. He has, that emotional intelligence. And another big fan that I just was wondering if you could comment on this. There's that triune brain theory where we have three parts of our brain. We have the reptilian part that's kind of the, feed, protect our territory. And then we have the mammalian part, which mammals have, like that causes dogs to wag their tails, causes us to feel emotion. And then there's that neocortex, that thinking part that we as humans have that separates us. And something that we've done with our kids is we've realized that our 2-year-old is big-time reptilian brain. He wants everything. This is mine. I'm upset if you take it from me. This is my territory. And then with our 5-year-old, he's way more emotional. He feels it. And then we're beginning to see in our 7-year-old, he's beginning to take more time to think about it. And one of the things that we've done up to this point is we've really focused on that emotional side and having our kids realize what is the feeling they feel. Are you mad? Are you sad? Are you angry? And so that it's been helping us so far, but, just with kids, and as I know, having three boys and they're all completely different, it takes a lot of patience. So I was just wondering, if you could just comment on any of that.
All right. Thanks a lot, John. So John's kind of breaking it down by brain science and where he thinks his kids fall in that measure. Did you look at that approach?
I think everything he said is correct, and it sounds like his kids are each at the right stage where they're supposed to be for their ages. There's a lot. There's these two kind of almost complementary or contradictory strands of child developmental science right now. One says that what you do earlier in life, the earlier, the more important. So even prenatally, what kind of nutrition, for example, or the stress level of the mother. And then, you know, infancy, like that the kids form secure attachments become with their caregiver, is really the basis of whether, even in an adulthood, they're going to have successful human relationships, intimate relationships. And so one strand of science is increasingly emphasizing very early life conditions, and the fact that, like, kids' dies are cast by the time they reach kindergarten. For example, class disparities in cognitive functioning in school are already present in kindergarten, basically, and you know, and schools really can't make that up. On the other hand, we're increasingly learning that brain development is a lifelong process, and in fact, there's a good reason that that insurance companies are rational, car insurance companies, that is, to give under 25 drivers a higher rate, because really the connections between your emotional brain, as he calls it, the reptilian brain, and your prefrontal cortex, is the more kind of sanguine, you know, intellectual aspect that makes good decisions. Those connections aren't truly completely forged until you're really 25. I mean, it's why we, you know, teenagers are the way they are, and so, you know, it is a lifelong and even brain development even occurs after that. Some people argue. So there's different things to do at each stage. I don't cover everything in the book, but it's meant to be kind of a funny dip into the science, and to make it go down easy with kind of funny stories and my own mishaps and so forth.
One of the things you referenced when we started talking was some of the signs about perseverance. Another word for it is grit, and that kids who just keep on going are the ones who are going to succeed, as opposed to the kids who quit too early. Did you look at that at all, and how you could maybe, you know, it's one thing to see that research and another thing to instill it in your kid. Did you look at that one at all?
Yeah, so I was always very concerned about that issue, particularly with one kid with ADHD, which is counter to that, obviously. And so one thing I did, which is probably the wrong thing, was that I wanted, I know that math, for example, in terms of shifting to cognitive ability, math is an increasingly important skill in our economy. It's often a weeder subject for a lot of entrants to higher education and so forth. So I really wanted to train my kids in math. So I ended up literally bribing them to do extra math during summers and during school vacations and on weekends. Sometimes money, sometimes video game time, sometimes gummy bears, whatever it was at the right, you know, appropriate ages. And one of the worries about using bribery on your kids is that if you bribe people, this is at least a theory, that you bribe people, then you undermine their intrinsic motivation to do that thing. In fact, like, you know, they will have less desire to do math than they started with once I removed the financial incentives. That didn't turn out to be the case in my kids' case, but what did happen was that they then saw, like, everything I would ask them to do in terms of market. Like, oh, how much do I get if I do it that extra thing?
I'm familiar with that.
We kind of have a little market system now of fines and rewards for different behaviors. You know, has that ultimately led them to be able to persevere and do things that they wouldn't have done otherwise, or is it kind of screwed up their entire thinking where they no longer can just do something, but, and this is my son in particular, but they want to be rewarded for everything? That's a, you know, that's an open question, I would say, right now. But definitely, at the time, at least, I was focused on, I wanted them to be able to focus on math for longer. And because math is a very demanding, you know, subject that requires that kind of perseverance. Other psychologists I know have argued that you can put a mitten on a kid's right hand, you know, their dominant hand, and make them do simple things like open and close the door, brush their teeth, whatever, with their less dominant hand. And just that very act, which requires a kind of consciousness and mental discipline to do it, will actually, you know, help develop the brain's discipline that extends to all tasks.
That's so interesting. And these things, you know, you hear stories like this and little tricks that might help your kid in the long run. They might really help them as they develop. On the other hand, I don't know, did your kids ever get sick and say, you know, Dad, we're not guinea pigs, just leave us alone?
Definitely. In fact, the book ends when they kind of are it's just starting adolescence, and now they're in high school, and definitely they're in full-fledged insurgency mode and revolt. So I think my experimenting days are over, and now it's more delicate negotiation, or, you know, letting them push, you know, the whole parenting strategy has to change, where you have to, they have to get their independence, but you also have to, you know, provide boundaries and firm foundation. And no, definitely they will not let me. I think their days as guinea pigs or lab rats are over. But, you know, when they were really young, they didn't kind of realize what, you know, what was going on. And it was all, of course, for their best interests. And I gave them gummy bears at the end.
Dalton, we only got about a minute left, but one of the things I think you care most about is the best way for a parent to express love. Do you have any words of wisdom about that?
I mean, one quote I have in the book is from a psychiatrist that said nobody was is ever on their couch complaining that they got too much love. So I you know, ultimately, you know, you're gonna at best be right, you know, slightly more than half the time in your decisions, and in the science, even if you're informed by science. But I think as long as you are showing, you know, in my case, what I wanted to raise was kids that were inquisitive, that were themselves kind of natural born scientists, and you know, I wasn't obsessed with whether or not they have a perfect GPA or could, you know, do 3 hours of violin practice a day. And I think that my love and caring did come through. Through my intense involvement in sort of trying to do the best thing for them from the science, but each parent obviously has their own way of expressing their connection and attachment.
Dalton, thank you so much for coming on and talking today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Dalton Conley, the author of Parentology: Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children, But Were Too Exhausted to Ask.